Yogi Hinlin is a professor, environmental philosopher, and expert on our polluting of creation and how we can evolve our way out of this existential dilemma and regain the awe, reverence, respect, and humility that our ancestors had, and to save us in our present historical dilemma. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit. Life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
I'm Roger Walsh, and our co-host is John Dupuy, founder of iAwake Technologies. One of the recurrent themes of our podcast has been how we can best respond to the increasing global problems we face. And more of us are wrestling with questions of, what can I do? And how can I orient my life so as to contribute most effectively to alleviating some of the great challenges of our time? Our guest today is Dr. Yogi Hinlin, who has devoted his life to these questions, both personally and professionally. He's trained as a philosopher, a political scientist, and he's now a professor at both the University of California, San Francisco, and at Erasmus University in the Netherlands. He's really a polymath who works on topics such as public health, environmental philosophy, sustainability. Of particular interest, the role of corporate malfeasance in creating and maintaining some of the great public health issues of our time. He's coined the term chemical Anthropocene, and maybe that's a good way to enter in here. Yogi, welcome, and first off, well, thank you for your work. Perhaps we can start with this concept of yours of the chemical Anthropocene, and you could tell us, what are we facing in terms of the chemical soup in which we now live and swim and breathe?
Well, first of all, thank you, Roger and John, so much for having me. The chemical Anthropocene is this notion that in the strata of the geological record that we are leaving as human beings, our changing of the composition of the Earth's chemistry is perhaps one of the largest indelible marks that will be part of our legacy. And this means that above and beyond the sort of biological metabolism of our bodies that we and all other species leave as marks in the world, that we've also concentrated certain chemicals. We've extracted certain molecules and alkaloids and brought them into the world in ways which they defy the natural accumulation of particular parts of those chemicals because we compartmentalize them away from their entourage chemicals that are found in nature. And this can be done through synthesizing new chemicals. It can be done through concentrating chemicals that already pre-exist in the environment in amounts that are not found otherwise. But we're also finding this in our own bodies in ways that we have no idea how this is affecting us, our psychology, our emotions, our actions. In many ways, are being altered by the chemical composition of our air, water, and soil.
Yeah, and as I understand it, we now produce tens of thousands of novel chemicals. And there are a number of families that one hears of repeatedly, such as hormone disruptors and forever chemicals. But perhaps you could just give us a kind of overview. What are the kind of major categories of chemicals that we're now imbibing and living in and as?
So we know about planetary boundaries, right? There's been, since 2009, a lot of work done on looking at what are our boundaries from the Rockström et al. Paper exploring the safe operating space for humanity, there have been updates periodically. I think the last one came out last year. And what we're finding is that, especially with novel chemical entities and chemicals that through like nitrogen through the Haber process, which we found a way to get around the natural nitrogen cycle on this planet, that we are producing excesses of certain naturally occurring chemicals to the degree that we're changing the Earth's chemistry. I have research projects that have focused on glyphosate and PFAS. PFAS is a family of chemicals that encompasses more than 10,000 different perfluorinated compounds that have effects on our endocrine system. They're known as forever chemicals because they bioaccumulate in our systems. And just as we know that we should be careful for making decisions that affect seven generations in the future, these chemicals are known to persist up to seven generations in our own human evolution. And so we, as living beings, as Homo sapiens, already bearing a toxic load. One could say this is our part of the accumulation of our allostatic load. And that this means that instead of each generation being born with open pathways, that we are actually creating a path dependency in future generations based on the chemicals that we are exposing ourselves to willy-nilly. Nobody, no DuPont CEO wakes up in the morning and says, I want to expose my unborn children to endocrine disruptors that may cause them hardship in their life or major birth or developmental defects. Nobody says that. And yet, by not paying enough attention to how sensitive we are as organisms, we are, through Teflon pans, through Gore-Tex jackets, through trying to waterproof things that we need in one way or another to waterproof. But by going for expediency, and in addition to that, in going for profit at the exclusion of precaution, sometimes we end up producing environments for ourselves, which are not just toxic to us and our generation, but are ensuring a certain path dependency of toxicity for future generations of all life on this planet.
I just want to say I'm getting ready to go back into the studio and record, and the song I'll be recording is called Seven Generations, just what you're talking about. So that's one of those things. And I wanted to ask, at some level, educated people understand, maybe not specifically, but they understand what we're doing in our industrial, you know, growth and everything that we've done and the reasons behind it and profit and the good things that have come out of it, as well as the negative things, like the fact we're sitting here in different parts of the earth and having this conversation, and people from all over the planet are going to be listening to it. I mean, incredible things that generations before us never had. But how do we, the work of changing consciousness so that, for example, the idea of in France of invading Spain at this time, it'd be ridiculous. No, of course we wouldn't do that. It's just completely beyond the pale. We wouldn't even think about it. But for centuries and centuries, that's exactly what was happening in Europe. And Europe has evolved out of that. So how do we get to the point? And I was reading, I think Roger and I had different parts of the elephant when we were getting ready to talk to you. And I was listening to a talk you gave on a paper you'd written about ecodelic commitment as semiotic praxis. At some point you could explain to me exactly what that means. But in the rest of the talk, you were talking about this change in consciousness that happens. And I definitely recognize that in my own life at some point. And I say this with great shame, that when I was a young boy, I would lived in a hunting thing, and I would go out and I would shoot animals to see if I could, if I was a good shot or not. And thinking about it, that's a complete obscenity. And I still can weep about it today when I think about it, but something radically shifted. And it had to do with vision questing. It had to do with hanging out with Native Americans and ceremonies. It had to do with plant medicine and all this stuff, and being a wilderness guide for, I think I spent over 1500 nights sleeping under the stars in Southern Utah wilderness. That will have an impact. Trust me. Yeah. But all that, I now have a reverent feeling for the natural world. And I also suffer with depression. So when I'm suffering with depression, I'm cut off from that. I just see it as stuff. And when I'm healthy and when I'm open, they're my brothers and sisters. And, you know, I would do nothing not to show them love and respect and realize that it's part of me and I'm part of them. So how do we, in the questions that you're raising about the ridiculous things we're doing with our industrial age and chemicals, how do we get human consciousness on a group level to begin to see, no, we're not going to invade Spain. We don't do that anymore. That is an obscenity. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks for sharing your personal journey, John. I think that many people can identify with, you know, the fact that we're all works in progress, right? And that if it weren't for the patience of mentors and friends, teachers, and, you know, those who lead by silence, that it would be a much harder path for all of us. And I see the more than human world as, you know, our greatest teacher, because the judgments, the projections, the inflation and deflation that we carry around with us in various ways has no place. It's not sticky when we're dealing with the more than human world. It simply is in a way that's so radically different to all of our judgments that we have this opportunity to have the birth of philosophy, right? In wonder, Dhamma Dzain, right? All philosophy comes from wonder, said the ancient Greeks. And this notion of wonder at our universe, this reverence, which is a experience that defies all words, as Lao Tzu and so many other have indicated to us, is the gift. You know, it's being in the gift, whether it's the gift economy or the gift of existence, that we can appreciate and maybe to whatever extent we can in our own lives, pay it forward. So I find that, you know, there are so many different ways of being that we are each day, right? We have to pick up the phone to do something. We go online, we're doing research, where we have to go shopping for groceries. And these different modes of us, these different environments, these different mindsets, these different relationships call us into being in different ways. And some of them are much more prone to teasing out of us certain ways of being that we don't enjoy, that don't feel pleasurable in our bodies, but also that create more tension, right? They are tension productive rather than tension relieving, or using that tension towards something, right? When I have to fill out paperwork for bureaucracy, I don't feel that my species being, that the reason for my life is being actualized. In the same way, when I'm writing or I'm reading or I'm giving a class or talking with you right now. So we've erected all sorts of barriers, I would say, to our unmediated appreciation and apperception of the world around us and of ourselves. And so I write a lot about looping processes, because my ontology, my understanding of being, is not inside out, but rather outside in. And so this idea that I am because you are, mine, I believe, is en la cache. They say we exist because of the relations that brought us to this moment. And so this interdependence, this interdependent co-arising, which we benefit from by being able to have this relation so that we can communicate and share the nuances of our particular perspective, our subjective view on things, can come about through attending, different ways of attending. And some of that in our current saturated culture can come from fasting in various ways, fasting from media, fasting from routine, fasting from work or from sleep or from eating, all the different ways in which we can take a break from the grooved habits and patterns, which we may not have agreed in the first place to get on that train, but somehow we find ourselves inexorably on that. And so the more opportunities we have as a society to create these circuit breakers, I believe the more peace we will have, the more attentiveness to the sensitivities of self and other, so that we can reduce the harms that are perpetuated through our current haste and our way of living.
Yeah. And so one of the questions that then comes up, both relationship to your general work and the issues of our time, is how do we call forth the best in each other and appropriate responses to these great issues? And it feels like your work has been one of making information available about some of these challenges in ways that haven't been done before. Does that feel right? Does that feel a description of what you're trying to do?
It does. I believe that all of our endeavors are storytelling in one way or another. Science is storytelling. And many of the most inspiring scientists for me are those that are able to convey their wonder for the world. And I don't think there has to be this classical disjunct between the explanatory sciences and the ones based on understanding. This is an old German debate between Erklärung und Verstehen. I did my PhD in Germany, and so I'm very sensitive to this age-old separation between understanding the world through analysis and understanding the world through trying to become part of the mindset of the other, whatever that other might be. So it's in hermeneutics, it's the join of horizons, where the horizon of me can meet the horizon of another. And that I can, the word understanding, I love, because it literally means to be humble, to stand underneath that of another, right? And it's the same in every language, that in the West, at least, that I know. And this humility means that if we want to know, we have to listen. And if we want to listen, we have to cultivate certain habits that don't denigrate ourselves, but are able to learn authentically in ways that are novel, right? In ways that aren't prefigured, pre-categorized by our suppositions or judgments. I've been greatly influenced, for example, by Ian McGilchrist in this line of thought, but also others. You know, there's the classic distinction between apophatic and cataphatic thinking, or being open to novelty, transforming our systems of beliefs and of taxonomies of concepts, and reaffirming the concepts and categories that we already have. And it's, you know, a classic example is, we could look at, you know, the rise of LGBTQ rights. Now, one way would be to say, yay for gay, right? That would be affirmative, cataphatic. So there's pre-existing categories that we did already acknowledge, and we are now elevating a previously denigrated category in our interest agreements. But the apophatic way would be to say, maybe gender itself or you know, sexuality is much more fluid than these predetermined categories have given rise to. Maybe we're all queer in a little way, in different ways, more or less. And that opens sort of from an XY vector, it opens a Z, right? Opens another dimension for our thinking, so that we can rearrange the ways of seeing the world that we previously were attached to.
And I would imagine some of the challenges of that is how to communicate that knowledge. I've become very frustrated with the progressive world. Sometimes you're homophobic, you're homophobic, you're homophobic, you're bad, bad, bad. You're a racist, you're a racist, you're a racist. Now, some people hear that and go, really? Oh my God, you know, I got to knock this off. But often it will alienate people and just like cause them to get even stronger in their resistance and become worse racist or more homophobic. So how do we communicate that? And do you feel there's a teleological, I hope I'm using that word correctly, movement in our human family to where these things that you're talking about will start to come online as we continue to evolve out of our old way of looking things, so that we're, maybe there's a force in the universe, or a force in the species, or force somewhere that's actually pushing us to these higher levels of consciousness, where we can be one with the world, the natural world around us, and recognize that which we've lost in the progress of modernity. We left a lot behind, and we damaged our world in big ways. But are we headed towards, if we survive, and you know, if we don't blow each other up, but in the meantime, to that, if we just keep doing the work, and the answers to these challenges will begin to just constellate and come online, and it will begin to move, you know, in great direction. If you look at the way the world was looked at by the majority when I was a child in the 1960s and what we're at in the 2020s, there's been huge, huge shifts in the populations. And we don't see that often when we're living right in the middle of it. So do you feel that maybe we're not, I don't know, there's forces bigger than ourselves that are helping us move in the direction of more enlightenment, of more compassion, of more connection with one another and with the natural world?
Well, I see in the background, you have a picture of Martin Luther King there, right? Who famously said, you know, the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. You know, he says it's long. It's yeah. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, which means that it's not a linear process. Now, I think you're talking about, in part, this awakened awareness of what's been called ecological civilization or planetary civilization. This notion that we are a global species, right? Human beings have found niches where, you know, more niches than any other organism, or animal at least. I'm not going to say organism, because bacteria and other microbiota are very, very clever and able. But more than any other mammal, we find ourselves every corner of the earth. We've learned how to adapt. And now we are linked inexorably through commerce, just like Immanuel Kant in his book on cosmopolitanism. He was looking for, you know, how do we create a perpetual peace? Well, he said, well, you trade with each other. You make your lives so entwined that there's no way that you would fight against somebody else, because you would have no incentive to do so. You would be shooting your own foot. And that's one way. You know, the internet has brought us all together in a way that we never have imagined before. You know, I still remember growing up and the moment that the internet came to our household and the early days where it really was a frontier for sharing rather than the sort of walled gardens that most of us experience the internet world now. I think Douglas Rushkoff and Cory Doctorow have done excellent jobs in sharing with us how the internet has changed and been captured by industry in mechanism rather than the early days where it was just sharing everything. And I personally tend not to believe that the world or the fate of the world is independent from our actions, that we are intimately bound up with the fate of the world, and that this means that we all have a responsibility to do whatever our purpose is in being that tiny little puzzle piece to create the world in which we are praying for, right? That we're imagining that we would like for others and ourselves and our loved ones. But to do that, it's largely, I would say, a negative process, right? A via negativa. It's the taking apart. It's a de-armoring rather than needing to do more things, to achieve more things, to create more movements, because we are already connected in so many ways. And if we can find the ways in which our own blind spots can be tactfully, lovingly addressed by others, we're more apt to listen, right? There's I forget if it was in Ebony magazine, but or in something else, but it talked about calling people in rather than calling people out, right? Instead of canceling people, there's a way of reminding people, say, hey, you know, in our community, we generally speak to each other a little bit more respectfully. You know, I think maybe what you meant was that you felt offended by something and hurt, and that you'd appreciate if you would describe or talk about these things differently. And I think bringing one's own feelings into account allows other people to see how feelings oftentimes supervene on thoughts, and thoughts oftentimes supervene on feelings. And so when we think we're being logical, oftentimes we're being logical to the ends of an unexamined feeling. And when we're being very passionate, it's because there's a thought, an ideology behind it that may not be fully in our awareness. And the more we're able to account for our own full process as human beings, the more we can create that field that gives other people to permission to account for the entirety of their experience, and to slowly be able to find gentle, soft ways to erode, like the waves on a cliff, our own blind spots and ways in which we have these defenses which are keeping us separated.
Yeah, Yogi, you're talking about, you bring in the whole topic of skillful communication and bringing groups and communities to harmony as opposed to disharmony and conflict. And I love that concept of calling in rather than calling out. That's very beautiful. And there's a lot in what you said, but one theme there, you emphasized our interconnection, our interdependence. And yet, at the same time, in our earlier discussion, which maybe this would be a chance to come back to, on the chemical Anthropocene, as you call it, we have companies that are producing chemicals which haven't been adequately tested, many of which are increasingly turning out to have major health and ecological consequences. And as you said, head of these companies don't get up with deliberate malevolence each morning. And yet it happens. And it happens in part because some companies are very effective in manipulating public opinion. You've brought to light some of these ways. Maybe you could tell us something about that.
Sure. Yeah, this is a very important question to me because I'm actually writing a book right now called Industrial Pandemics, The Spread of the Corporate Virus and How to Stop It. And it distinguishes between businesses which grew out of local needs for goods and services through the process of the first limited liability companies in the Netherlands and the Dutch East India companies in Britain, these short shareholder companies that then basically became their own countries with their own militias. And they went out and they did whatever necessary to bring profit back, including colonizing, subjugating, committing genocide all around the world. And that's why I see decolonization as the fundament for how to move forward. And again, going back to John's question about teleology, this is sort of a negative way of putting it, decolonization, rather than, creating something necessarily positive. But that's only because I have such a positive view of human nature. Yeah. I believe that we fundamentally, as human animals, seek joy and love, love to share, are willing to take small hits in personal welfare for the benefit of all, are willing to share suffering so that suffering doesn't always fall on the same group, on one group. We're willing to distribute the advantages and disadvantages of being in society, right? I believe that that is our natural state, and that it takes a lot of violence and trauma and indoctrination to get us to a place where we don't want to do that. And the evidence I have is looking at little children. Becoming a father has been one of the most transformative experiences in my life, to see the innate sweetness, right, in who we are as the human animal. And yet we're dealing with the fact that we are, on almost every metric, we are overshooting the limits of our biosphere. And that this not only has been systemic, but now there is an entire, and arguably for 100 years, an entire product defense industry, which maintains this destruction at all costs, insofar as this destruction is linked to profit. And if I'm to go back to that metaphor between, you know, of, you could say, original sweetness, I think businesses want to be respected by society. I think that, you know, this is the notion of the freedom to operate or the social license that companies need. If we, as a society, say, hey, tobacco industry has no place in our society, they end up hemorrhaging money because of litigation, because of all the liability, because of the enhanced regulations that they find punitive. They have to, any company has to stay in the good graces of the public. And yet, how you do this can be done in various ways. You can do it manipulatively, you can sneak, you can greenwash and whitewash and all the other sorts of subterfuge available, you know, with consultants and advisors and law firms and lobbyists. Or you can simply say, let us know your needs, town hall style, and we will do our best to have these major shifts. And we look at people like Paul Hawkins and other, you know, Patagonia and other leaders and companies that have taken the lead to align themselves with societal expectations and to go beyond. However, most companies cannot do this. Most industries cannot do this. Why? Because they are stuck in a sick system of, if we're talking about game theory, they are stuck in a system where if Facebook says, we want to make our Instagram and Facebook less addictive, we're going to make it less addictive. If they do that, they're going to become the next MySpace. And they know that. Because if they make things less addictive, but their competitor doesn't, then they realize, oh, TikTok, they're the new celebrity. All the young people are using that, which is in fact the case. So you look at interesting things where you have Facebook and Google going to Washington and saying, please regulate us because we can't do any of these good things that you want us to do unless that applies to everybody in our industry. We need a level playing field. And at the same time, they're also lobbying against a level playing field. And so it's that contradiction. It's that what Gregory Bateson would call the double bind that prohibits these companies from being moral actors and prohibits our legislators and regulators from doing their job because they are getting all the time mixed messages, mixed incentives. And in the current game theoretic model that they're operating in, that it would be suicide for them to do otherwise. Same with any other company that has to maximize its externalities, whether it's on labor, on the environment, on people living on the other side of the world. We are living in a sort of international relations system of anarchy, right? If you go to school for international relations, they tell you about multipolar worlds and what happens when you are in this game where, you know, it's not unipolar or bipolar. When you have a multipolar world, alliances can change, fortunes can rise and fall. And all of this is dependent on, in essence, a arms race. We are currently engaged at a very high level in a global arms race to get to devastating, catastrophic AI as soon as possible, to extract as many resources as possible, to extract as much as possible from our labor force so that we can do these other things. And in the process, we happen to be destroying and undermining our democracies, our governance structures, our economic and political systems, the basis for life on Earth in our biosphere, and the health of all human beings, whether you're at the top or you're at the bottom.
Yogi, you just pointed to the painful paradox of our situation, that we have a dysfunctional reward system or a perverse incentive system, which catalyzes this race to the bottom and race to collective collapse, effectively. And people get penalized for pulling out of the race or for acting in ways which even mitigate the harms. So do you see any, what are there solutions? I mean, the way it's often presented, the way you present it, it's like, wow, yeah, there are a lot of potent dynamics here, and it's hard to see a way
give
out.
Give us some hope, Yogi. Absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, Roger, because obviously we seem to be stuck, right? Yeah. And when you're stuck, when you're in the hole, it looks like there's no way out, right? When we're in the mindset of this. And so I see this perspective shifting as being very helpful. As John mentioned earlier, you know, taking an ecodelic perspective, and that's a term that my good friend Richard Doyle coined most prominently in his book, Darwin's Pharmacy. But elsewhere, he talks about psychedelics, right, as not as being mind manifesting. But what are they really doing? Are they manifesting something that is only in our mind, or they manifesting ecologies? And when we're talking about ecodelics, we're talking about set, setting, and matrix, right? You might have heard back in the 60s, you know, they had this notion of substance, set, and setting. Then later, this term matrix was also included. And the matrix is the background beliefs of our society, the way that we design both in terms of our ideals, but also the material design of our society. And we oftentimes think that, oh, wow, there's so many forces that are a speeding bullet train towards oblivion. That's our current game theoretic way of operating, and how governments, corporations, even NGOs are working, right? That there's the NGO industrial complex where they need funding, so they can't really do the work they want because they have to do stuff that's going to make their funders happy. And if they actually solve the problem, they'd be out of work. You know, so there's all these dynamics which make it very difficult for anybody to actually be effective at what they're doing, no matter how big, right? And you can talk to presidents of the United States who say, I can only do so much, right? You can talk to the CEOs of trillion-dollar corporations, and they say, I'm just, you know, we're just one company. And so there's this learned helplessness that has been ingrained at all levels of power, which seems to be inverse to the actual power and responsibility they have. Because if you go to a favela in Brazil, you'll see many people who have figured out a way to make it work amongst themselves. I'm not saying it's easy or painless, but they have figured out a way to live together, to meet each other's needs with nothing. And oftentimes, you know, I think it's Charles Eisenstein who made this point. One of the difficulties of coming into community, really living in community, and I live in the Netherlands in an eco village. I joke that it's not very eco or village on either of those dynamics, but still it's really nice. And, you know, today we don't really have community, maybe in the sense that I'm thirsting for it, because none of us need each other. None of us are really interdependent on each other. You know, if my neighbor dies, you know, I'm sad, but it doesn't affect my life. My other neighbor loses their job, you know, I can commiserate with them, but I sort of, you know, don't bat an eyelid. And previously, actual intact communities had decentered selves, first of all. Ourselves were not, you know, these individualistic notions of the self, which is actually, if you look at history, it's a very recent development, right? That I could somehow go anywhere in the world and do my work and be financially independent, be socially independent from my surroundings. Look at Socrates. He chose to drink hemlock and die rather than be ostracized from the Athenian. Rather than leave his community, he preferred death because he would lose himself. He would lose his terra, his sense of place, all of his relations. It's for the same reason why I feel that it's a crime to take elderly people from their homes, put them in environments where they don't know the smells, they don't know in the night the furniture, how to get to the bathroom, like the back of their hand. They don't know people around them, the store on the corner. None of that is familiar when we take people out and remove them from their communities. In biosemiotics, we call this semiocide, destroying the meaning-making structures of people. And so the hope that I would give is that meaning is a participatory event that we can engage with others, human and more than human, and creating structures of meaning and commitments is the fastest way to get out of depression, right? Going and working at a soup kitchen, helping somebody else out, serving someone else, sacrificing, you know, some of one's own comfort and convenience for the sake of another is one of the fastest ways to dispel the specter of depression that hits so many of us. You know, and I too have had depression in my life, and being in nature and connecting with other people and serving have almost always dispelled it so quickly that I couldn't even remember that I was depressed.
And those are the things that disappear. The three things you just mentioned that go away: service, community, a connection with others when one is
depressed. And nature.
And nature, absolutely, and nature. And it just goes away. And the fact that we can live around each other, but not really be connected to each other because we don't need each other. And I think that's why there's so much appeal. Well, one, I was in the military, you know, and there's a sense of connection with your unit, with the men around you, that is just amazing. And even though, you know, it's not really good circumstances, you don't find in normal everyday life. Team sports, I think, often replicates that sense of bondage, of being one all together at its best. And extended wilderness trips. I was a wilderness guide for many years. So you go out there and you start to become dependent on each other and the environment around you. There's a coming together that's it's holy, that very hard to achieve in our normal life circumstances. And then there's eco villages, which you said was not really eco, wasn't really a village. And then there's other experiments such as cults and stuff that have run into its problems that sometimes give that feeling. But it's often based on the shadow aspects of the leader thereof, and it all goes to hell in a handbasket. So how do we recreate that sense of connection with one another, with nature, with community? And I think I'm thinking of my own answers. We're living also in a psychedelic age now. It's all coming back online. And some of your writings, you've talked about your concern about it being taken over by capitalism and desire to control and make money instead of kind of the sacred basic idea. And I'm not sure you can control psychedelics, even though you might like to. I think it's going to be doing its work, maybe unspoken, unnoted, but people are going to be changing and opening up to experiencing reality in a more sacred, connected way. Stay tuned to part two of this immensely important and moving conversation with Yogi Henlon. Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done that a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.